Views and opinions expressed by the hosts are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of their employers. This podcast may not be suitable for children. Adults may find details triggering and/or offensive. Listener's discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. This is Priscilla.
And this is Norma.
And you're listening to
It's a Mystery for Me.
To another episode of It's the Mystery for Me. We hope you guys had a very happy Easter if you celebrate Easter, and if not, then I hope you had a really good Sunday. In podcast news, we do have an announcement regarding the future of the podcast. We know this will probably upset many people to know, but we've decided to end the podcast just short of our 3-year anniversary. So episode 100 will be our last episode. This is episode 98. It wasn't an easy decision to make, but we feel that this is the right one. We started this podcast as a hobby, and it quickly turned into a job, which I don't think we anticipated. Balancing it with our actual lives and other things we had going on. Personally, for me, I was feeling very overwhelmed.
I don't know that I can necessarily say the same, but I think the researching aspect of it took a lot of time.
Yes.
And that was more than what I was expecting.
Right.
For sure.
And we want to give you guys the most well-researched episodes, and that was becoming harder to do. Just for context, it could take anywhere from 10 to 15 to 20 hours to produce one episode. This isn't a decision that was made overnight. A lot of time was spent reflecting about it. As for next steps, I'm going to be working for a place that focuses on the main theme we see in the cases that we do on this podcast, which is violence against women. To go from talking about these types of cases on a weekly or biweekly basis to working on the preventative side of these cases is truly a full circle moment. I don't know if this means goodbye forever, but it just means goodbye for now. And we really hope that you guys will support this decision. It's a decision, again, that, like I said before, wasn't made quickly. It was something we really thought about. And for me personally, I had to really take a serious look at my life. I think what I saw was that there wasn't too much balance when it came to like work-life balance. I felt like aside from working, that I had a lot of different hobbies I was interested in, and this hobby in particular became a job, and so there was just like way too much on my plate, and I had to really just reflect about it and be like, okay, this isn't healthy, and I have to just pick one or two things and kind of stick to those things so that I can give my 110% to those things. You can keep up with our personal journeys by following my TikTok or Instagram, Legally Priscilla, or following Norma's account on Instagram, which is Some Norma Loving. If we said the names too fast and it was hard to jot down, you can go to our Instagram page for the podcast, It's the Mystery for Me, and our personal Instagrams are linked in the podcast bio. So you can just click on it and it'll bring you to our pages.
But yeah, I think overall, we're just really grateful for the opportunity and the fact that you guys came back every week to listen to us and just leave all the positive comments and feedback. It's definitely appreciated and something that I'll always be grateful for.
Same. We really want to thank you guys for your continued support. It is because of all of you that the podcast blossomed the way it did and that we were able to share so many stories about Black women and Black children. We hope that we did the families proud. We hope that we told these stories in a way that was compelling yet respectful. These stories are not easy to tell. However, we know that the families and the friends of the people that we've covered on this podcast, you know, they have a tougher journey ahead. They had to live these stories. Okay, so we just want to thank them for their support. We want to thank them for reaching out to us privately and sharing details with us about their loved ones and for sharing their thoughts on the podcast overall. For this week's episode, I watched an episode of 48 Hours, which is on CBS, but it also can be watched on YouTube, and I've included the YouTube link. I also read an article from the New York Times by Michael Wilson on this case. For a full list of today's sources, go ahead and check out our website. It's themysteryforme.com or click the link in today's show notes. This case takes us back to 1993 in Long Island, New York. This is the Katrina Brown Lee case. Based on the articles that I read, it seems like Katrina's birthday is around October, around like the early 70s. I think it's harder when we're doing cases on like things that happened in the 1990s, like early 1990s or like before that, because it's harder to find information, it's harder to find court documents, etc. But here's what I could piece together based off of the episode and the one or two articles I found. In the late 80s, Katrina was living in the projects in Brooklyn with her grandmother. At age 14, she had become pregnant. The pregnancy was a result of a relationship she had with another teenager. So at age 14, Katrina had a daughter. Based off the show, Katrina just did not have the best foundation, especially during her formative years, her childhood, and definitely early teenagehood. In the late 80s, when her daughter was around 3 or 4 years old, Katrina met Alex Irvin. I could not locate details about how they met, but he was a correctional officer at Rikers Island, and Katrina felt that she had hit the jackpot. This man had a job, right? A good job. And he also had a car, and he had a gun, which a lot of people might go, Interesting. I think I can understand why Katrina saw that as a plus, especially growing up in Brooklyn in the projects. It's not the safest thing ever, right? Mm-hmm. So someone who has a gun and it's a legal one, you know, it can be seen as someone who's powerful. Katrina realized pretty quickly that she hadn't, in fact, hit the jackpot. Alex Irvin had already started to beat her in the project's courtyard. It started with verbal abuse, of course, and then it escalated to that. And she was living with her grandma at the time, and so she went to her grandma for advice. Katrina wanted to leave him. At least that is kind of what her mind told her, right? Like, this is a dangerous situation for you and your daughter.
Yeah.
You should probably see your way out. But her grandmother insisted that she give Alex another chance, despite knowing everything that was going on between him and Katrina. Sometimes adults who are supposed to guide you, they fail you.
Yeah.
Right. And honestly, this is very commonplace for a lot of older women to insist that you make it work with somebody who's abusing you. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times it's because they're used to that being like the average situation, right? Like, hey, at least you have a roof over your head and he has a car and a job, right? Okay, so he's beating you a few times a week. You could take that.
Right.
Right? I think that's a lot of people's mentalities, especially like the boomers generation. And
I also think it's the whole image of having like a close-knit family, of like having a mother figure, a father figure, and a child.
Right.
Just, yeah, to show face.
Exactly.
Okay, we're a couple, we're together.
Mm-hmm. And also, Katrina had her daughter, right? That wasn't Alex's daughter. So maybe the grandmother also thought, hey, this is great that you got somebody who is willing to like be in a relationship with you. You have a child already and he's raising her as well. You should just suck it up because maybe you won't find anyone like that, right? Like, there could have been a thousand things that the grandmother said. But stuff like this is very dangerous. And it really, really bothered me to know that her grandmother encouraged her to return. Because Katrina, as an 18-year-old or 19-year-old at that time, she's very impressionable, right? And so she's going to the one adult that she trusts. And so the adult you trust is telling you to do something. It doesn't seem right in your head, but I mean, you trust them, so you're going to roll with it, right? So her and Alex move into Alex's mom's house together, which is empty, though they don't talk about why. I guess maybe the mom lived somewhere else. Maybe she was in the process of selling it. I'm not sure. And by 1990, Katrina and Alex have their own child together, another daughter. So now she's a mother of two little girls. Okay, so like I was saying, Katrina is now a mother of two little girls, but she was still getting beat repeatedly by Alex, which is not surprising because that's how abusers are. It's very, very rare for an abuser to change their ways. According to a New York Times article written by Michael Wilson, Katrina was even hit in the head with a chair. If it could hurt her, Alex was going to do that. Katrina would actually call the cops many, many times during these episodes. And Alex would show his badge, and that was that. The cops would not help her. Instead, they would just tell her to work it out, figure it out with each other. Katrina's story is not one that is uncommon. I think that a lot of police officers have a certain view on domestic violence, and many of them are very quick to say to work it out, right? But the reality is that domestic violence can escalate to a point of no return. That is the truth. That is what statistics show. It's said that Alex was triggered by things like the baby crying, or maybe he had a bad day at work, or maybe Katrina did not want to have sex with him. I mean, she had just had a baby. Your body's changing, like, you know what I'm saying? And you are literally abusing her. What is sexy about that? You feel me?
Right.
So these things would anger him. And the New York Times article says that Katrina was constantly raped by Alex, literally deplorable human being. Alex eventually moved Katrina and the two little girls to a house in Long Island. It was the summer of 1992 at this point, and she was pregnant again. I think that's what ultimately motivated her to leave. She didn't want her kids to endure this anymore, not the unborn child, not her two little girls, and definitely not herself either. Just for a timeline sense, by the summer of 1992, her and Alex had been together around 5 years. Based on the timeline given by the episode, it seems like Katrina might have moved out of the Long Island home with her two little girls around December of 1992. Her goal was to separate from Alex completely, but she soon ran out of money. About a month later. Based on the articles, it seems like she would have been around 6 months pregnant or so at the time. And so she called Alex and she just told him that she had run out of money, and he seemed different, pleasant, good mood. This was a side that she wasn't used to seeing from him. So she let her guard down. So there seems to be a gap here in the story that's told on the episode and also the very thorough New York Times article. What I gather from it is that she was still going to leave Alex, but she wanted to at least come home and get the kids' clothes. She didn't take a lot when she left for the month, right?
Okay.
It's not said if he was gonna give her money, if he promised her money or anything like that. But it just seems like she was going to stop by the Long Island home as a pit stop. Katrina was around 22 years old at this point. Her oldest daughter was around 7 or 8 years old. And her youngest daughter, probably around 2 or 3 years old. And so Katrina left her oldest daughter at a neighbor's house. Now, in a different article, it said that she left her with her friend and had a play date. But regardless, the oldest daughter wasn't with her when she returned to the house.
Mm.
Her youngest daughter was. So let's talk about that day that she returns to the house. So Katrina returns to the house for that pit stop of picking up the clothes and stuff like that on the morning of January 9th, 1993, which is my birthday. Mm. So I would have been 2 years old that day. When she gets to the Long Island house, Alex opens the door. It's said that he is just kind of stoic. He's very given just weird expressions and stuff. But Katrina places their youngest daughter in the youngest daughter's room to sleep because it seems like it was nap time for her. When Katrina leaves the bedroom and she goes into the living room, that is when things go very left. Alex takes out his gun and he shoots her in the stomach twice. Remember, Katrina is pregnant at this point in time. Right. She's about 6 months pregnant, maybe even 7 months. Her stomach immediately flattens as a result.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Wait. Right. So she's still alive. She tried to crawl on the floor at this point, and she's shot in the arm. So now that's 3 bullets. She got close to a landline. Remember, it is 1993. Cell phones are not really a thing at this point in time. But she realizes that the phone line is cut. At this point, she's kicked in the face by Alex. Every time he shot her, he said, "This is the day you die, bitch." And sometimes he'd change up the phrasing and say, "Is this one?" the one that's going to kill you? Like, let's see, type of shit.
This is definitely a unhinged person.
Oh, very unhinged. He emptied the gun. It only took 5 bullets at a time. At that point, he reloaded the gun with 5 more bullets. He continues to shoot her, stomach and chest, specifically.
And she's pregnant with his baby.
Yes.
Wow.
He had a plan. He had a plan that day. His plan was to kill her. It was to make her suffer.
But she's carrying your baby. You know, I would think if this is his plan that he would wait for her to deliver the baby and then do all of this.
Right. In a New York Times article, it said that when she told him that she was pregnant again, he said, "I don't want a baby."
Oh.
Right.
Oh, okay.
But is this the way you go about it, though? At one point during his shooting rampage, he places her on the bed and he takes out Band-Aids and places the Band-Aids over the gunshot wounds. He then takes her into the bathroom and just kind of leaves her there. It seems like he was planning on shooting her some more. And maybe he thought he had planned this out really, really well until there was a knock on the front door. When he opens the door, it's his friend. The New York Times article said that this friend is also a cousin. Listen, sometimes we call people our cousins, they're our friends. I don't know, but it's his friend, okay? His friend cousin. And for context, I don't know how old Alex is.
That's my next question.
At this point in time, right? Like, it didn't seem like he was so much older. It seemed like maybe he was mid-20s when he met her and she's like 18. So he could be now like late 20s or early 30s at this point. When he opens the door, the friend just looks around and the friend is startled because there's so much blood on the living room carpet. The friend says it looked like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. At that point in time, Alex looks at his friend cousin and says, "I shot Katrina and flipped out." He brought his friend to the bathroom where Katrina is lying on the bathroom floor, just bleeding out. And the friend immediately picks her up and brings her to his car. Mind you, the friend was only 20 years old, but had the sense that something's wrong here and something needs to be done.
Was the friend able to get out safe, though?
Because Alex goes out. Well, Alex goes out with the friend and he helps the friend to put Katrina in the car. Now, there's no mention of the little daughter, if she was still at home, if she heard the gunshots, if she ran in. Not for nothing, I feel a little bit like the Mandela effect happening. So the Mandela effect is basically like when you remember something happening a certain way, whether it might be like a TV show or like music, I don't know. You remember it a certain way, but then you rewatch it years later and it's different, right? So my Mandela effect in all of this was I could have sworn that like in this episode, which I've seen before, that her young daughter had come in, had seen him shooting at the mom. But when I rewatched the episode, that wasn't what happened. And I honestly was really confused. I kept rewinding it. I was really confused. I was like, no, I could have sworn that she came into the room. But I don't know. That's just my 2 cents. All right. Anyways, it's not entirely clear where the little girl is, but Alex and his friend cousin, they drive Katrina to the local hospital. And the friend, when they get there, takes Katrina out, puts her in a wheelchair, and then speeds off with Alex. The hospital staff is completely freaked out seeing Katrina. Like, her body is just riddled in bullets. He had loaded the gun 2 times. They take 5 bullets each time, and he had shot her 10 times.
And she's alive at this point.
She's barely clinging on to life. So much so that the assistant DA goes to the hospital to get a dying declaration from Katrina. For those who don't know, dying declaration, it's one of the rules of evidence. It's rule 804. And technically, it would probably violate the hearsay rule. All you gotta know about hearsay is it's kind of exactly what you think. Like, it's a he said, she said. Like, how do you prove that he said or she said something in court, right? So a lot of the times people will be like, that's hearsay. It's not coming in because we can't really prove that. A dying declaration kind of goes around the hearsay rule. And to get this statement in under this rule, you have to show that the declarant, meaning Katrina, believes that she is dying. And the DA could prove that. Her body is riddled in bullets. The doctor is telling her, like, she might not make it. We're going to pull her into emergency surgery. Like, do your thing fast because we have to go. So it meets all of the evidence requirements to come in under that rule. Katrina tells her who did it, and she's rushed into emergency surgery. While in there, according to the New York Times articles, they are able to remove 4 bullets, but they left 6 bullets inside of her because removing those could hurt her. So they had to leave it in.
What about the baby?
So after the surgery, it was just a waiting game. Katrina is placed in a coma. And according to that same New York Times article, Katrina wakes up from the coma 33 days later. And when she wakes up, the first thing she does is ask about her children, her 2 little girls and her baby. The 2 little girls are safe. They are with family. There's nothing to worry about in that sense. The baby she was pregnant with, a little boy, actually, he unfortunately did not survive. It's said that he only lived 2 hours once he came out. He did not survive, obviously, because her injuries were so severe. The article and the show don't go into how badly the baby was hurt, but you can assume if she was continuously shot in the stomach and the chest area, that the baby was either hit by a bullet or he was affected by the lack of oxygen, or maybe the bullet affected the placenta or did something that, you know, made it so that he was not going to be able to survive. I can only imagine also the guilt she felt in that moment of, like, why did I go back? Like, I know how he is. Like, he set me up, you know? But at the same time, she's probably thinking, like, maybe he had a change of heart. Maybe he is, you know, being nice. I've never left before. So maybe this has made him kind of change his attitude about stuff.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it was a setup. She walked into a setup. The doctor has more bad news for her. First, she was told that she would never be able to have any other children. And then she was told that she would never be able to walk again.
Oh my goodness.
That she would need a wheelchair for the rest of her life because she was paralyzed from the waist down. She still had other injuries that needed repair. And over the next few months and years, she had to endure many different surgeries. The New York Times article lists these as follows: gallbladder surgery, colon and vagina repair, bladder surgeries, partial hysterectomy, hip surgery. Mind you, she's only like 22, 23 at the time.
That's really insane. Wow.
Now, you are wondering with Alex, like, what was going on there. So the police went right over to his house to arrest him, and his badge could not save him from the arrest. He apparently said when they walked in, oh, I was expecting you guys.
Oh, wait. So he didn't go on the run?
No.
When they fled from the hospital?
No, he went right back to his house.
That's crazy to do all that just to be like, okay, I'll right. just wait here.
Right. Exactly. So he was arrested and he was charged with attempted murder. Now, there could have been other charges, but this was the one that was emphasized in articles and on the show.
What about, like, the son dying, too?
It didn't make any mention about him being charged specifically with the death of his unborn child. He's being held, and it might be actually Rikers Island where he's being held, but I'm not completely sure. But how wild would that be if he was being held at the place where he was a correctional officer? Because if he's abusing Katrina, do you think he wasn't abusing prisoners in the same way?
Sure.
Abusing his authority, etc.? So I'm sure they would have loved to have him as the prisoner. Katrina, after this, of course, was incredibly just down, right? Depressed. She wasn't really an active participant in physical therapy. I think a lot of this was just very heavy on her mind. Like, my life is over. Should I even put in the effort to try and do anything at physical therapy? It's not like I'll ever walk again. Like, I can't believe this has happened to me type of stuff, you know? But the physical therapist told her that he knew that she would walk again. And that inspired her to give her all in physical therapy. And within a year, she had gone from walking, like barely standing up, to using, what's this called?
A walker?
A walker. I'm making like circular motions with my hands. It looks like I was drawing circles. A walker, then she went to a cane, and then she was able to walk.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
She had angels protecting her.
Right.
Because to be shot at 10 times, be paralyzed, and now you're walking?
Yeah.
It has to be God.
It has to be. And the story is not over yet. After her accident, she lived with Alex's mom at Alex's mom's house. Now, I'm not sure if it was still empty at the time. It seems like Alex's mom was now possibly stopping at the house. I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure why she wouldn't have lived with her grandmother. I don't know if her grandmother was still alive at the time.
Mm.
Or maybe they had a strained relationship, right? Because her grandmother had insisted that she make it work with Alex.
Mm.
But she felt like the only place she could go was to Alex's mom's house.
That's still a little scary, though.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Too close for comfort, but at the same time, if she doesn't have anywhere else to go,
right,
what can she do?
Really? She's doing whatever she thinks is right, you know? What she thinks is going to provide her daughters with some sort of normalcy through all of this. One day when she's at the house, his mom says to her, basically demands that she writes a letter on Alex's behalf. And she wants the letter to say that Katrina actually shot herself 10 times, that Alex did not do it. Katrina is not with it. And according to articles, Katrina was thrown out of Alex's mom's house as a result, and she had to move to a shelter with her daughters. The shelter apparently was so dirty that Katrina preferred using the local McDonald's bathroom to that of the shelter. She would shower her daughters in the sink. She would shower herself.
Wow.
She said it just was so disgusting at the shelters. And that's horrible that that is the shelter experience. Like, a shelter is supposed to be a home for people.
Mm-hmm.
Not like the bottom of the barrel. Like, you know what I'm saying? People go through transitions and they're hoping to get a place that is safe and clean, comfortable. I feel like that's the bare minimum that you could give people. Safe, comfortable, clean. Like, what's going on? You feel me? Where are our government dollars going? The taxes y'all be taking out of my check, where are y'all putting it? I want to know.
This was also the 90s, right?
Right, but still.
Maybe things are a little different. I hope things are different now.
I don't know. Somehow, Alex was still able to call her from jail and get in touch with her. And he started to tell her exactly what he wanted her to do and pressuring her. And the prosecutor found out. Now, this prosecutor was very tough. Very tough little woman. Like, she's just very, you know. And she wanted him under the jail. So when she's hearing that he's calling Katrina and basically threatening her, she's not liking this. Around that time, it looks like there was a court hearing. And during that, his defense team reads a letter that says, "I, Katrina Cook, the victim in this case, have decided I don't want to press charges due to duress at the time of my accident." And then it goes on to say, "If I'm subpoenaed to court, I will testify on the defense's behalf."
Wait a second. And this is actually a letter from Katrina.
It is said that she wrote from Katrina.
I would make sure that she actually wrote it and do some sort of comparison.
Well, at first, see, the thing is, on the show, it said that she later told the prosecutor she didn't write it. However, this is what made me think, okay, maybe she did write it. So the prosecutor calls Katrina after court and she's pissed, okay? Because she's just like blindsided by this letter, right? Like, "I've been working on your case. Like, what's going on here?" And, you know, she basically asked Katrina what's going on. And Katrina said to her, "I'm not coming to court. I'm going to disappear." And the prosecutor yelled at Katrina and said that she would hunt Katrina down like a dog if she did not come to court. And Katrina hung up the phone. I was like, well,
interesting choice of words.
Right. No, that's exactly what I thought. I said, that's kind of interesting to say. And in the New York Times article, the prosecutor does say that she could have used different words, right? Like, that wasn't probably the best choice of words. She was just very frustrated by the situation and she just couldn't understand why Katrina was refusing to testify, which is interesting to me because I think when this DA started, I mean, she must have just been in the beginning of her career, right? And like, you know, not much was known about domestic violence at that time, right? Like, research is constantly being done. Sure. And I think that the prosecutor didn't understand the psychological component of like not wanting to confront your abuser. Like, mm-hmm. you are afraid. You are still like kind of under their thumb, you know? And so there's different ways to handle it. But I've seen prosecutors handle it the same way this prosecutor handled it. Like, when I go to court for volunteering stuff, I would volunteer for a domestic violence nonprofit. I would see even defense attorneys talking to clients in that way. And I remember sitting there and thinking, you know, as a volunteer, I had to sit in on this like statistics on domestic violence thing, and it explained how difficult it is. But what I would witness was like these lawyers like really talking down to people who are already down. You feel me? Like, mm-hmm. there's ways to mm-hmm. say it. Like, you could be frustrated and stuff, but I just think like it's a very delicate situation. You have to know how to say things.
Yeah.
Because then if not, like, people just shut down. Like, you yelling at her that you're going to hunt her down like a dog, I mean, she hung up the phone.
Yeah.
Right? So it's kind of like, okay. And yes, the prosecutor was also on the show and reiterated this line as well on the show. And she just talked about the fact that she just really wanted to see him punished for this. You know, she had seen the crime scene photos. It had basically lit something inside of her on fire. But anyways, the case continues to move forward. And you might be thinking, okay, how can it move forward if Katrina doesn't want to testify? Because they have enough evidence. They don't need Katrina to testify. So the prosecutor is just like, we're just going to keep this thing pushing. So in the spring of 1994, a year and 3 months after Alex has put Katrina through the worst nightmare ever and has tried to take her life, they are now at jury selection in court. If you have never seen jury selection, I really encourage y'all to really go to your local courthouse, ask them what criminal cases are on like the docket that day, and just sit in. Like, I had never sat in on any sort of court case until I was in law school. Mm-hmm. And I was in a class that was called like jury in America. And we had to go to court as part of our assignment. But me, a law student, had never sat in court, but I sat in court and it was so fascinating to me because it was also jury selection that they were doing.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But I actually had to like tell on one of the jury members because they were already privy to the case. This case was being retried. It was a man who had basically, I'm pretty sure he had like shot someone in broad daylight or something. And when he looked at me in the eye, like, I just felt cold. Like, I don't know, like cold ran over my body. It just was like a very dark look. I wasn't going to say anything about what I heard the jury members say, like, because it's clear that they knew, they were a potential juror at that point. So they hadn't been appointed yet. I wasn't going to say anything because of that. They weren't appointed yet, but they were saying things about the case that they had already heard about. Like, they knew that he had been found guilty already the first time and that this was his retrial. And you're not supposed to know that. Oh. So when I saw that that juror got picked to be on the actual jury, I had to say something. Now, so the jury selection process was over. And then I had to say something. And I remember the judge was so annoyed and they had to do it all over again. And jury selection could take like a day or two, sometimes longer, but they had to scrap the entire jury.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they started from scratch.
I thought it would just be that one person.
Nope. They just like had to go back to the drawing board. I don't know what happened to the case. I can't remember the guy's name or anything, but the judge was like, seemed annoyed with me. But I just felt like that was the right thing to do because like you're supposed to get a fair and impartial jury. They're not supposed to know what has happened, right?
Right.
So, yeah. Anyways, all of that to say, when jury selection is happening, the defendant is in court. So Alex was in court that day. As they're doing the jury selection stuff, and when they're doing jury selection, they're just basically asking the jury certain questions. They might ask jury members if they've ever lost a child, because Katrina lost a child. And so they might ask them that and how they feel about like being on a jury and, you know, someone shot a pregnant lady. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So they're like asking very specific questions that are related to the case because they want to know if you can be unbiased, right? And some people might admit, listen, no, I can't be unbiased. I, like, this happened to me, you know, and I just can't separate the two. So jury selection is all about like just asking people questions all day long until they feel like they pick the right people and blah, blah, blah. And now they have the jury. So As this is happening, the doors of the courtroom open one day, and Katrina walks through the doors. And everyone is shocked to see her, even the prosecutor. They're like, huh? Because you said you would never come to court, right? And so what happens? Alex sees her, and something, I guess, at that point he saw that she maybe looked like she wasn't going to take no shit from nobody type of shit. And so what did he do? He took a plea deal. After they had done jury selection, after all that was done, he took a plea deal. And the prosecutor was pissed. She was pissed. She was ready to just, like, nail him to the cross type of shit. She was ready. And Katrina was not surprised he took the plea because she saw how powerful the badge was. And so she felt like, so I think she just wasn't surprised that he was kind of circumventing the court process for an easier process of just like going straight to sentencing. Mm-hmm. And she truly believed he wouldn't get a lot of time, but the prosecutor was sure that he would get the maximum of like 20 years. And then when the judge sentenced Alex, he actually sentenced Alex to the minimum amount of time. He gave him 5 to 15 years, which means that as soon as he hits around 5 years, he would be up for parole, which means he goes up in front of a board of random people and he pleads his case and tells them, you know, you guys can let me out now. Like, I swear I'm good and da da da. And they decide whether or not he could come out. That would happen right around the 5 year mark. But this also meant that, like, he would not go to prison for longer than 15 years.
Right.
What do you think about Alex's sentence?
I'm actually really surprised. What was he facing up to 20? Like, 20. Maximum was 20?
Mm-hmm. He got 5 to 15.
I'm surprised that it was even that low. Like, yeah. The maximum was 20 years for attempted murder.
Yeah, right.
So that's shocking. I thought that he would get the 20, or maybe in between 15 and 20.
Me too. I definitely was surprised because you can't ignore the fact that he shot her 5 times. Mm-hmm. Reloaded his gun another 5 times and then shot her another 5 times. Like, that is a very deliberate action. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I feel like that's not something that should be overlooked. So I'm surprised that, you know, he only got 5 to 15 years. I have no idea if he had priors or anything like this, if he had a criminal history. I could not find anything about that. But either way, this... Mm-hmm. It's very serious, very severe, mm-hmm. right? At that time, when he's being sentenced, she's just really starting to walk without a cane. I'm appalled by it. So Katrina tries her best to move forward with her life. And according to the New York Times article, she had taken a police exam for like to be like a traffic cop years before when she was actually still with Alex. And she happened to get a letter in the mail in around 1997 about... Okay, being an actual traffic cop. And from there, she actually became a police officer, which led her to entering the police academy in 2001. When they ask her on the show, because Katrina does appear on the show, why did you want to become a cop? She said, I wanted to become a good cop, right? Not just a cop, a good cop. Because those types of cops have empathy. She was actually part of the 9/11 class. And so when 9/11 happened, she had to go out as like a first responder. In the meantime, Alex was still in prison. And according to the New York Times article, he was denied parole twice. One person on the parole board questioned releasing him, mostly because of the fact that he reloaded the gun to continue shooting Katrina. Mm-hmm. Seems like the person saw it for what it was, what it looks like. Deliberate action. After almost 10 years, in 2003, Alex Irvin was released from prison. Katrina, on the other hand, continued to work as a police officer, and she did a lot of work as an undercover cop. The New York Times article says that she would, in particular, dress up as a butch lesbian. I don't know if they use the word butch lesbian, but that's what I saw it as, right? They were basically trying to say that in a politically correct way. But you know me, politically incorrect. So it says that basically she would go and buy drugs from drug dealers, right? And then the cops would come in and arrest them and stuff. So she was helping with that process by pretending to be someone who was trying to buy stuff. She also worked undercover as a prostitute, arresting people for soliciting a cop, right? Or technically who they thought was a prostitute.
Yeah.
So it didn't require her to actually do anything with these people. It's like, probably the second they exchange the money and agree on it, boom, you know, they'd get arrested. The New York Times article mentioned something jarring. She met a young girl out there while being undercover as a prostitute who liked to carry a bag of dead roaches because she saw them as her friends.
That's random.
That's very random. She said 99.9% of the girls she met during this time had been abused themselves, which makes sense. What's interesting is Katrina never told anyone what happened to her. She didn't want her bosses or anyone at work to question her ability to do her job, right? Maybe they would question if she was psychologically capable or even physically capable if she had been completely honest with them. Throughout the years, Katrina continued to climb the ranks of the NYPD. She eventually became a first grade detective, which is one of the highest rankings in the NYPD. Very few women hold that accolade, especially Black women. In 2014, she was chosen to be part of Mayor de Blasio's security team. And so she worked with Mayor de Blasio every single day until until she retired in 2021. And around that time, she was around 50 years old. It was only then that she told the mayor, listen, this is what happened in the past to me, and I'm writing a book about it. He's like, okay, so, like, well, what's the book about? And she's like, well, I was shot 10 times by a cop and, you know, and told him, and he was in complete shock. And something she said on the show really stuck with me. It was just like, do I look like someone who has been shot? Like, when people see me, is that, you know, no one could tell, right? No one questioned her. So she's like, do I look like someone who's been shot? And it made me think about, like, other random stuff. Like, do I look like someone who might, like, be depressed sometimes? Or do I look like someone who, you know, it's hard to tell by just looking at someone. So she was able to, like, hide this for so long because maybe she didn't look like it, right? So you're probably wondering, where is Katrina today? I'm sure she's enjoying retirement. Now, like she mentioned to Mayor de Blasio, she was writing a book, and the book is going to be called And Then Came the Blues. But I could not find a release date for some reason. It's not on Amazon. I went on her website. We'll link that as well. There wasn't any update on the book. It might still be in production. And that's why I actually held off on doing the episode so long, because I thought the book was going to come out. I had actually seen this a year ago and just wrote it down. She founded a program called A Rose is Still a Rose in 2012, and it focuses on just helping at-risk young ladies, educating them, mentoring them, inspiring them, empowering them. And when I went to the website, there were so many different classes people could take, one of them being about their legal rights and understanding them, which I was like, that is so dope. If she reached out and said, come teach a class about this, I would be like, absolutely, I'll come teach a class on this. We would definitely do that. There was one about vision boards and creating that. Like, there's just so many different classes. Yeah, there's so many different classes. And so I'm going to link that so you guys can check it out. There's also a donation page in case anybody wants to also make a donation. That's something that we're going to do. And we encourage you to go ahead and do the same, because it's true that at-risk young women are more likely to be in these types of situations, right? Like, that's what statistics show. If there's a way we can help to change that narrative, I think it's great to do that, right? On an interview which happened on the talk show The Real, Katrina credits her healing as something that God has done for her that she couldn't have done without his presence in her life. She said it took about a year to heal physically, but it took years to heal mentally, as one can imagine. She also says that she has forgiven her ex. If you're wondering what he's up to now, I found an article from the Cinemaholic that said that he was working as a manager for some sort of like healthcare company and that he was living in North Carolina. But there's not much information on him at all beyond that. There is no information on whether or not he is close with his kids or anything like that. as far as like the one child he has, I don't think like Katrina's daughter, I don't know if her Katrina's daughter had that type of relationship with him.
Right.
Or feels any type of alliance to him, you know? But I wonder about her other daughter that they share together.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if we find out any of this information, then we will definitely let you guys know at the beginning of the next episode. We'll give you a little update and whatnot. But that is the story of Katrina Brownlee. It's definitely a change to be able to tell a story about survival.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, she made it through. That's not, unfortunately, the case for most of the cases we cover on here. We just wish her healing, because even if like this happened so many years ago, I can only imagine that it haunts her to this day. You know, it might affect her in certain relationships that she has. Mm-hmm. There's just so many things that can be affected as a result of this trauma. We're so happy that you made it through to guide the youth, to guide your daughters. Mm-hmm. We understand the dynamics that come with domestic violence, and you did the best that you could do with the knowledge you had at the time. You're so young, right? Mm-hmm. And I think even just making the effort to leave, that's the toughest part. And you did that. So thank you for sharing your story on the episode of 48 Hours, on The Real Interview. And we look forward to reading your book one day as well. That concludes this week's episode, and we'll see you guys in 2 weeks for episode 99. Until then, stay safe out there.
Bye, guys.
Bye, y'all.